Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson. And from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. R.J. Young loved a woman. The woman loved her dad. Her dad loved guns. So R.J., who had spent his whole life staying away from guns, plunged headlong into the gun world. He ended up building enough skill to become an NRA-certified pistol inspector. But he also grew to have deep reservations about the effects of gun culture in America, especially for people like him. He has turned those thoughts into a book called Let It Bang, A Young Black Man's Reluctant Odyssey into Guns. Here's our conversation. R.J. Young, but before we get to your book, which I want to talk about in great detail, we need to talk about an even bigger subject in some ways, which of course is college football. You are, I assume at least some of the people who are hearing this will know this, you are a relatively diehard Oklahoma Sooners fan. In fact, you've got a YouTube channel that's sort of OU-centric and is really popular out there on the internet. That's where I learned just recently, in fact, that you guys have a quarterback coming in next year named Spencer Rattler. Please, God, tell me that's a real person.
That's and he's an all-timer. I've met him personally, met his family, and yes, that is his real name.
I'm gonna have a hard time not rooting for Spencer Rattler. I'll tell you that right now. So now then, as you well know, back in January, your Sooners played my Georgia Bulldogs in the national semifinals in the Rose Bowl in what I will stipulate is might have been the greatest college football game of all time. I tweeted it at you after the game. You were very gracious in defeat. And I know I have felt several of those defeats in my life. And I guess I'm just wondering, what did you do or what was it like for you in those moments right after the game was over?
You know, Tommy, I listen to this podcast off and on, especially when you have on someone that I particularly know a bit about and I want to hear at great length. So two of the favorites for me are, of course, Junior, because I'm a closet NASCAR fan, and I loved your profile, and, of course, Spencer Hall. And to hear that, you know, you got a little bit of that with the Alabama loss, but you also didn't feel the need to relive it, I was so envious because I was in tears after that Georgia game. I was coming apart because I know a lot of those boys. I covered them. I know their families, and it was also just one of those things where it felt like you weren't going to have another opportunity, right? That's how it felt. It felt like every time you get to that particular stage in this sport where everything is imperfect, where passion is the currency of the day, that you're not going to get back there. And I even know, you know, as an OU fan, that you've been to two semifinals in the last 3 years, man, come on. But, I did not have your experience. I was not able to just get up and do the dishes. I sat there for a good long while just in my own soup.
I think either of those are equally valid ways to process that stuff. And the good news is, with a couple of breaks, we might get to do it again this year.
It seems so. And I got to say, you guys seem like you're in the driver's seat. You get a big W against Alabama, it's going to be hard to keep you out.
I would not feel confident if I was either Notre Dame or Michigan right now. So I think there's a shot that possibly both of us could get in there, which I would really look forward to because that was a lot of fun last year for sure.
Yeah, I hope we get to do it again.
Yeah, me too. So let's talk about your book. First of all, so that people are sort of grounded from the very beginnings of it, it's called Let It Bang, and tell people where that title comes from.
It actually comes from a rap song that is called Let It Bang. It's by ASAP Ferg, and I chose that title. I have a few. The sitting title for the book is, I'm sure you've been in on these conversations, people like, people don't like, and you have to go round and round about what it is it might be. I haven't met too many people that get to land on the first title that they like. And we chose that title because it was the antithesis of the story that is ASAP Ferg's Let It Bang, which is about a black man saying, I'd rather just shoot you and be done with it. And Ferg is rapping about his Uncle Syke. And his Uncle Syke is the kind of person who walks around with kitchen knives, who would pull a Tech Nine out of his slacks in the middle of a club to make his point. And that's not me. And that is not what I believe at the end of this odyssey, this journey into gun culture. I would rather let you shoot me. I would rather let it bang in the opposite way.
Tell folks a little bit about your background growing up, that sort of thing. I know both your folks were military, but it sounds like from what I've heard that there really weren't guns in the house or anything like that when you were growing up.
Yeah, that's right. I grew up in Hattiesburg, Mississippi, which is also my mom's hometown, my grandmother's hometown, and we spent a little bit of time in North Florida before we moved to Tulsa, Oklahoma. But guns were never just a part of what we did. I mean, you knew about them, you knew they existed, saw movies, they're on cops, but my parents never made that a big thing. That was not one of the things that we grew up with, my sister and I, and it was not one of those things that made us a family. Sports did, right? I played baseball growing up. My parents are huge NBA and football fans, and we are avid in it. My parents are those kinds of folks that buy NFL Sunday ticket, right? So that was how I was brought up in the world, and I come to find out as an adult that the way that I was brought up around sports is the way that some people are brought up around guns, and that was new to me.
I think all of us, just as part of being in the culture, seeing movies, watching TV shows, listening to music and stuff, I think everybody feels like they have sort of a, I'm not sure if a working knowledge is right, but at least some sense of how guns are used, how they're misused, how they're abused, how they work in some general sense. As you went into this book, it becomes pretty clear that even though you had maybe absorbed some of that just as part of the culture, that the actual workings of guns were pretty unfamiliar to you, right?
Yes, that's also correct. I was a neophyte. I was deathly afraid of even holding a firearm, and that took me some time. But a lot of this was in the academic way that we learn what it means to hold a gun, right? Because some people are given a gun with their dad and they go out and they hunt. I read about the things before I ever really got a good sense of what it meant to just hold one in my hands and to figure out how they worked, which is how I come to settle on a Glock and how I get to know so much about that pistol in particular. But along the way, one of the things that I learned that I found just fascinating was just how effective a tool a gun is, particularly a Glock and an AK-47. For the purposes that they were invented to perform, I was unaware of how good they are at doing exactly that, which is killing people, and how effective. Like, one of the stories that didn't make it into the book was the story of Joseph Kony's Lord's Army. You know this one, Tommy? Child soldiers in Africa. So one of the things that they did was take surplus of weapons and bury them in the sand. This is in C.J. Shriver's book, The Gun, which is phenomenal if you haven't read it. I think it won a Pulitzer, actually. But they buried these AK-47s in the desert. And a couple years later, they came back and they unearthed them, and those bad boys fired. They were nearly perfect from a functional position.
So they're basically like the Terminator of guns. You can't destroy them.
Well, and they're the Terminator of rifles/assault rifles, right? That's how the Glock is too, because this was a gun that was made to replace another pistol for the Austrian government and be their military's firearm. And it was the kind of thing where they said, hey, we don't want this thing to jam in like 10,000 rounds. You can go through 10,000 rounds without that jam, and that thing didn't jam for twice as many shots. And even then, they weren't sure that it jammed. There might have been some user error there. So as a handgun, that thing is also not indestructible, but probably as close as we've gotten to with firearms. And that's a really heady thing to know that that is on your person, you know, to know that that's in your hand. And the way that I try to get this across to some people who don't necessarily handle even handguns is Mjolnir, which is Thor's hammer. Imagine you're walking around with Thor's hammer, and it can do all the things that Thor's hammer can do. Now imagine telling somebody, hey, maybe don't use Thor's hammer. They're going to tell you you're crazy. What are you talking about? So all of this was just kind of hitting me as I continued to dig further into not just culture, but just the science and the physics of firearms.
And to back up just a little bit and center folks on the narrative, you started learning about all this because you fell in love. And the woman you fell in love with had a dad who was a big gun guy. And so to sort of try to learn about his life, to try to have more in common, you decided to learn about guns. And I'm wondering, when you started, and you know, he kind of taught you how to shoot a little bit, he helped you get your first gun and that sort of thing, were you more afraid of like injury, you know, like hurting yourself or hurting somebody else? Or were you more afraid of embarrassment, like not knowing what you were doing or looking sort of, you know, small in his eyes, I guess?
I was deathly afraid of hurting someone. And I think most people who are adults who are handling firearms for the first time feel the same, right? Because you're going, all I got to do is trip and fall and I'm going to shoot somebody. Those sorts of thoughts run through your mind. Whether they're rational or irrational at that point doesn't really matter, right? It's just that you're afraid. And then later, no, I don't want to embarrass myself in front of my girlfriend's father. You know, that's not anything that anybody wants to do. And you really, I really wanted to impress him. And when I failed to do that, and then I felt humiliated in the failing, that is when I decided to make a conscious decision to try to get as good as you possibly can get, as a civilian at least, with a firearm. But yes, I started I wanted to know the man. You know, like we started out talking about college football because we have that in common, and you understand and I understand. This was a man for which I didn't have anything in common except his daughter, and that's not good enough, right? I have to get to know this man on the merits of him. Because we know why I'm here. He knows why, I know why he's here. But in reaching toward him to learn something about him that I was afraid of, that I was admitting I didn't know anything about, I wanted to try to build this bridge because, you know, I'm raised in the South and I know what that means. And I know that I can't just go around thinking that I don't have to get to know someone because they think differently than I do, or we don't seem to have anything in common. Maybe it's just incumbent upon me to take a step toward them and then a few more to demonstrate you're valuable, you're worth my time, I'm worth yours. Can we find some common ground to talk about?
And I don't think we've mentioned this yet. You're Black, and your girlfriend at the time and her family, they're white.
Right.
Did you feel like that was a sort of an extra hurdle you had to get across to find common ground with them?
Not in so much as race, but in so much as I'm a city boy, right? And this is a family that lives in the country in rural Oklahoma and was raised there. So there are cultural hurdles there that aren't necessarily race-driven, but they're there. So you'll recount a scene where I was taken to vaccinate cows. Tommy, I didn't know anything about vaccinating cows, man. What? And that was, you know, that was just a harrowing experience because it was new and I felt, you know, there was a little toying, but for the most part, it was just, this is what we do. This is who we are. And there were lots of moments like that throughout this courtship, where I'm just out of my depth and I have to continue to trust people to take care of me and to understand me and to lead me by my hand, or just quit and leave. Because, you know, first there's being humiliated and then there's fear. And when the two are there together, you can fly away real quick. And I just resisted that temptation.
Yeah. There are parts, talk about being mystified, where you are mystified at some of the same things that I would be mystified at, about just how to work a gun. There's several points in the book where you talk about just how hard it is, for example, in the Glock, just to load the magazine until you get it right. And you really struggle with that, right?
Absolutely. I would also put it to like throwing a spiral or learning to throw a curveball. I mean, there's technique to it. But if nobody's there around to teach you the fundamentals and the technique to do those things, you will struggle for a very long time. And that was me. I was trying to force bullets into a magazine without really knowing the fundamentals of what I was doing. And to watch this man, Charles, which was Lizzie, was my ex-wife's father, to watch him load this magazine was to see a man with arthritic hands who did not have the slightest problem filling that thing to the top. And I got to tell you, when you, the first couple, you feel like you can get those in there. But when you get to around 15, 16 of a magazine that holds that many bullets, it's very tough if you don't know what you're doing. And that was also a different sort of humiliating, because at the time I'm a strapping 24-year-old man. And you know, Charles is in his 60s, and like I said, his hands sometimes don't do what they tell him to do. And yet he was able to do this, and I was going, what am I missing here? And later I would learn exactly what that was. But yes, just little things that I don't think that people take them for granted. I just don't think that they're inclined to teach you.
And speaking of things that people might not know instinctively, one of the things you do in this book is you sort of go into the sort of history of gun culture a little bit and taught me some things I certainly didn't know. One of the things being that the NRA was much more moderate in its early days in terms of who should have guns and how many guns people should have. And in fact, there was a moment in the 60s when the NRA actually supported a gun control act, basically because it meant not as many black people would get a hold of guns. Am I sort of framing that correctly?
Yes, you are. And the watershed moment of the Black Panthers going to the state capitol in California with firearms and legislature saying, okay, enough of this. we can't have this. But that was also just, it was terrifically interesting to view the NRA as what it was, which was a sportsman's club. You know, where marksmanship was the idea, hunting was the idea. I mean, this first majorly known president, you know, was Olympian for marksmanship, you know? And then by the 70s, all of a sudden, Saturday Night Specials, the handgun, the revolver, scared a whole group of people. And by group of people, I mean white folks, in such a way that we have to get these guns out of the hands or make them harder to get for black folks. And this was weirdly cyclical, because that was the story immediately following the Civil War as well, right? And just making it more difficult and what that meant. And now all of a sudden, I say all of a sudden, over the last about 40 years, the NRA has pivoted hard to we are for the Second Amendment and almost nothing else.
Although, as you detail in the book, there are seemingly some exceptions there, one of them being Philando Castile, who was killed in Minnesota. He was legally carrying a firearm, got pulled over, was trying to tell the police officer that he was carrying, but was shot to death anyway. And you talk about that in your book, how some NRA members, or at least a few of them, seemed to be outraged that the NRA was not stepping up to defend Castile, who's black, but that the NRA, I don't think, ever really took a stand in his behalf in that case.
They came out really late. And by really late, I mean about 2 days. And we know that in this news cycle that we live in, 2 days might as well be 2 months. And I was one of the people that was critical, because this was an opportunity that frankly, the NRA didn't have before, to do the thing that they claimed to do, which was stick up for everybody who exercises their Second Amendment right lawfully. And to speak to people like me who genuinely believe that the NRA doesn't really care about me. It cares about telling people what they're afraid of. And in Philando Castile's death, I got to see that as truth. Because it's one thing to come out late, and I understand that, but for so many people to have to browbeat the NRA into saying, hey, and these are NRA members, this guy was doing exactly what we say you should do. Please say something, and you know that he's black, so this matters. Because we've had so many shootings of unarmed black men, frankly, boys and men, where we've wanted to have somebody to take our side, as you, if you would, you know, to somebody to say more than just, it's a shame. Because I looked at Philando Castile, but I remembered Trayvon Martin. I remember Laquan McDonald. I remember Terrence Crutcher in my hometown, Tamir Rice being a child. And what is the NRA telling those young boys who will eventually come into contact with guns? Because I say to people, anybody that wants a gun will get a gun because they're able to in this country. And if you have an opportunity to say to a 15-year-old, no, I had your back. Look at what we did for Philando Castile. How does that change the narrative? How does that change the argument? How does that change, hey, guns aren't going anywhere, but this is how we feel about it. I didn't see that, and I was heartbroken by it. Because it's not about necessarily hating the NRA. It's about, please call it both ways. And they didn't. And they refused to.
You mentioned Trayvon Martin in there. I know you had a moment in your training when you were trained to become NRA certified as an instructor where somebody brought up that case in sort of a bleak and weird way, right?
Yes. I was being sold what is called firearm self-defense insurance. My first encounter with it. By a salesman from a company called U.S. Law Shield. And the way that he chose to tell the story to sell folks on why they should have this $11 a month membership was, what if you were George Zimmerman? I'll follow you here. And you had to defend yourself against a hoodlum. To which, you know, at the time, I was so hurt, and I must have seen red-faced because he locked eyes with me and decided he lost me and kept on with his spiel.
Because there were other people in the room.
Yes, there were about 40 of us in the room, and I'm the only black person in the room. So, obviously, he's not telling this story to me. But just the idea that Zimmerman was somehow a victim here was just infuriating to me. Because to look at the details of that case in particular is to find out that Zimmerman's on top of Trayvon Martin with a gun to his chest. And that kid did not have a firearm. You know, he had fruit juice and Skittles. And we really did at the time look a lot alike. We wore hoodies, we wore Jordans, we wore jeans. I have a beard now, but I didn't then. I had a fade like him. It hurt in such a way that it's really difficult to talk about it without tearing up, to know that someone still fears me in the way that obviously Zimmerman feared Trayvon Martin. And how do I speak to that? How do I make the people in that room understand that's not true?
When we come back, RJ Young talks about the anxiety of getting pulled over with a gun in your truck. Especially when you get pulled over a lot. That and more, just ahead on Southbound.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com.
Each week on Southbound, we take a moment to highlight our listeners. This week, I want to thank the great writer Tom Junod, who shared a story on Facebook about our latest Southbound guest, piano player Chuck Lavelle. Tom has a band that actually played with Chuck at the White House Journalist Jam a few years ago. Here's what Tom said about it. "We weren't very good, but, well, he was. And his very presence on that stage and his disinclination to turn up his nose proves his nice guy chops beyond all reasonable doubt." Thank you, Tom. If you have stories or thoughts about Southbound, we want to hear from you. In fact, we've now got a new way to do that. Just go to our episode page at wfae.org/southbound, and you'll find a box where you can type in the name of anybody you'd like us to try to get as a guest on the podcast. So go ahead and submit those names at wfae.org/southbound. Put us to work. As always, thanks for your support. And now, back to our conversation with RJ Young. I noticed on the flap, sort of the author's bio on your book, it says about you, "He is pulled over by the police more often than most white people change their sheets." It's a nice line, but I do want to know in a little more detail sort of what's been your experience with law enforcement over the years.
Well, I was coached by my father from a very young age that you will be pulled over because of the way you look. And that seemed odd as a child, right? Even in the South, even in Hattiesburg, it just seemed odd. But then it would happen to my father. And it would be one of those things where you got pulled over and not ever really told why you were being pulled over. Just license registration. "Okay, here you go, officer." And then come back, have a good day. And I look at my dad and I'll go, what just happened? Well, you know, we'll talk about it when we get home because we obviously had something to do. But in my experience, I've been pulled over for driving my truck. And I've been asked, "Where did I get my truck?" A dealership, like I assume everybody else gets theirs. Or I've been asked, you know, "What you running from, boy?" Which I can't tell you how infuriating that is. But for the most part, it's just an odd look that I get. I get pulled over, and then it's almost like they want to see a black man in a truck in Oklahoma. And then, you know, run my license registration. It comes back with nothing, and I'm told to have a good day. Or I'm asked, "Is the address on my insurance current?" "Yes, sir, it is." You know, I'm asked little things, too, like, where am I insured? And I'll say, you know, it says USAA right there. like somehow I'm hiding something. And I've always wondered about that, and I really can't get a straight answer. I just know that I get pulled over on average about once a month.
Wow. I think I've been pulled over like 3 times in my life. You know, and in my case, all for like legitimate reasons, you know, like speeding or something. As far as I remember, I don't think I've ever been pulled over for no good reason.
Yeah, and to add to that, right? In the book, the idea of me keeping a firearm of any kind in my truck, that would terrify me. You know, like, you know, it's Oklahoma. Like I assume most places in the South are, like Georgia, for instance. If you got a shotgun or a rifle and you know, back of your truck, most people, it's just a thing, right? It's just what you do. It's your truck gun. But for me, if I had that, I can't imagine what questions I might be asked and the anxiety that I would feel. Like I, even driving to and fro when I was shooting.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Did when you actually had the Glock in your car.
Right.
And you, I mean, were you like super extra careful?
I would bring there's a plastic case that it comes in, right? And I would leave it in that case and I would slide it underneath my driver's side seat so that it wasn't in plain view if I got pulled over. And I was pulled over a couple of times when I had it, and I would tell the officer straight up, "Sir, I do have a firearm. It is underneath my driver's side seat. I do have a license for it." You know, and most times be like, "Okay, cool," because you know they can't see it, and if they can't see it, I don't get to it real quick, and they go on about their business because this is, you know, this is a gun state. So that apparently was not the thing that was off-putting, which is also just odd, because you would think that would accelerate things, right? The stakes would be raised that much quicker. But oddly enough, that seemed to be the thing that might put a police officer at ease about, yeah, okay, he's cool, because I got a gun, which is just, you know, it's just weird to think about. But it did happen, and thankfully nothing ever came of it.
So part of what you're describing here is sort of a power imbalance, right, where one side has kind of the leverage or the power in a given interaction. And I know that one reason people buy guns and like guns and want to keep their guns is that they feel like that gives them more of a balance, where they are empowered to, you know, to shoot back or to defend themselves or whatever it is. And I guess I'm wondering, as you trained to use a gun and then became really, really good at it, did you have those moments where you sort of understood where that comes
from? Oh, absolutely. I actually quote a line from Billy Batgett, I think it is, in the book about just the power of having a gun at the end of your arm. And like I was saying, it's like having Mjolnir. It's like being Thor. And you feel like you can do almost anything because you can. Because you really can. Because it's not only that you have the power to defend yourself. You have the power to take a life and take it easily. You know, there's no up-close personal sort of, to get real dark, strangulation or fist fights, right? It is a cold-blooded, quick thing that you can do. And it's a lot of power. And frankly, it's not just that I don't necessarily want that power or want the responsibility of it. It's that I don't really trust most people with it because they're not as reverent as I would want them to be. And this gets really interesting because I have this conversation ongoing with friends and my mother in particular, who you might have read about in the book.
Yeah, I was going to come back around to that. Your mom, after you left home and were away and came back, she kind of became a gun person.
Right, and that was also something that we had to work out, but also a grace, because my mother and I believe quite differently when it comes to political conversation. My mother voted for Donald Trump. I did not. My mother is a ardent Republican voter. I'm an ardent Democratic voter. And guns were something that not only we could talk about, but that I was an expert with at this time. And my mother is an avid enthusiast, but she's not an expert. And I was able to teach her. But she needs the force multiplier in the way that I do not, right? I am 31. I work out 2 hours a day. I don't feel as if I'm going to get assaulted and not be able to defend myself. My mother uses a cane to get around. She's in her 60s. She has back and neck problems. My mother's not going to be able to fend you off if you want to try to hurt her. And I talk about this with women in the book too. I see why some people feel that they need a firearm. What I don't see is people having a very frank conversation about the results implied in having to use a firearm. Like, just, I'm going to walk you through it, Tommy, because we're talking. If you shot somebody, what happens next?
You're
yes,
asking
I'm
me?
Asking you.
Well, I assume that if I was successful, they'd be dead. And I would either be going to jail or have a lifetime of guilt, possibly, depending on the circumstances. At the very least, that would be something that would never leave me, I guess is my first thought.
Right. And I don't necessarily think that people get that far. But also, and this is where the firearm self-defense insurance comes into play, you're probably going to get sued. Because it doesn't matter if the bad person was trying to hurt you. That bad person has family. And they don't like you. You killed their family. There's a case that I cite in the book about a fellow named Joe Horn who was being burgled at his home. And he was on a call with a 911 dispatcher. And he was saying, this ain't right. You know, I got a gun. And the dispatcher was saying, please, sir, stay where you are. No property is worth killing someone over. And he said it repeatedly. And Joe Horn couldn't take it. And he went out and he fired shots, killed one. I think a couple got away. He went destitute defending himself. And the story is, do you want to be Joe Horn? Do you want to be defending your right and lose everything in the process? Buy this insurance. We'll help you. But also, okay, let's say you're Joe Horn. Now your cocktail story is, so you shot a bandit or you killed a bandit. Do you really want to walk around with that? Do you want to be the person for which someone's father, husband, brother, wife, mother, daughter is taken? I don't, but I also know race is implied with me because this doesn't end well for me, especially if it's a police officer. If a police officer feels threatened by me and he shoots me, we know that he's probably going to get acquitted because we have laws that say that, you know, he's in his right. If I shot a police officer because I feel threatened, it doesn't matter if I was right. Probably gonna go to jail. I shot a cop. I killed a cop. But I also have taken a father. I've taken a provider. I've taken somebody's son. I don't want to walk around with that. And I get to say, I don't have any children. I'm all that's lost if someone wanted to shoot me. And that's not necessarily a conversation that I think people have with themselves. What I'm asking is intense introspection about why you feel the need to have a firearm for self-defense.
Obviously, you evolved or your feelings changed or you moved from one place to another during this time when you were learning and training. Was there something in particular or some moment that it sort of maybe turned sour for you?
Honestly, the writing of this book, do you know how we sometimes say, I don't know what I believe until I write it? I felt that with this book because by the time that I had set out to write this book, it was something else. It was different. It was a bit different in that I was still married at the time and I had something to say related to political climate, not necessarily guns, but guns was the environment. And I wanted to write a book about using a gun to get to know a person who was different than me. This would be Charles, and how that's a bridge unto itself and all that's implied there. But in doing the journalism and the research and the reading of the stats and also the way that I trained, you know, I went from training to be a marksman, which is how I got to be an NRA instructor, to training for self-defense. And what I found was I don't want the anxiety and the responsibility implied with self-defense for a firearm. Because the thing that I say is you're supposed to use that gun to defend yourself and get away. You use that gun to create distance between you and a threat. But what I see is folks think they're cowboys and they're gunning down an outlaw, and that means they're going to kill that person. And that's not me. You know, I get intense about football. That's about it. I don't want to be in a position to where I have to make a judgment call about killing someone. I would rather they have to do that.
So let's say that tomorrow, you know, several weird things happen and you end up R.J. Young as president of the United States. What would you do to make sure that people were safer with guns, or was there some sort of controls you would put on? How would you fix the gun problem in this country?
I'd hire people smarter than me.
That seems like a bit of a cop-out answer,
well,
I gotta say.
And it is, right? Why is it? Because, and this is where it's complicated for me. You've read the chapter about my grandmommy. This is a woman who sacrificed and lost almost everything so I can put a piece of paper into a box, because that's in the Bill of Rights. Second Amendment's in the Bill of Rights. And with my personal history and the history of Black Americans, the last thing that I am interested in doing is stripping anything away from the Bill of Rights. Now, I'm also not the person for which has a cure-all for gun legislation. You know, we're recording this the day after yet another mass shooting.
Right, out in California, yes.
And we're to a degree where it feels numbing. Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, it felt like yesterday. Vegas. I mean, the Aurora, 2012. I can't tell you, Tommy, that being armed is going to prevent any one of these things. I know that to be true. I also can't tell you that there aren't people who actually need a gun to be safe. I just know that I don't believe that there are nearly as many people who need a gun that have a gun. So what would I do? I'd ask you to get to know each other. I'd ask you to continue to talk to people you know you don't have anything in common with. Like I was actually having this conversation with a reporter a couple of days ago who asked me, you know, why I decided to put my guns and whatnot. And I said, because I have the courage to walk over to a person with a Confederate flag on their chest and ask them about themselves. You know, and that's not something that a lot of black folks or white folks for that matter are interested in doing, because they just automatically assume, and they'd be right most of the time, that they don't really agree with that person. But it's not about whether or not I agree with you. If we're not communicating, you're leaving it up to me to fill in the blanks, and that's dangerous, because that's how we got here. We have these assumptions that people are going to hurt us, so we have guns to defend ourselves, when really the assumption should be we're all afraid, we're all terrified. And what do people do when they're terrified? They reach for whatever makes them feel powerful. Not safe, powerful. A gun is a really good tool to feel powerful.
Do you feel like in the end, I know things did not end as you would have liked, and I'll get into that in just a second, but while you and your father-in-law were working with guns together, while you were learning things from him, do you feel like it actually did make you closer?
Yes, I have little doubt, honestly, because there's a difference between someone being short with you and curt with you about how they think that all football coaches should be fired because they make too much money, right? Which you're not wrong, but there's also a difference between watching Gunsmoke and saying, so where are the black folks? Or saying, why is Marshall Dillon such a big deal? And then being short with you, then being able to talk for quite literally hours about the merits of a .45 ACP versus a 9mm versus a .38, about talking about the difference between what the term, or talking about the term assault rifle for hours, or being able to say, you know, my experience with this firearm, with this gun, was different, or do you know how hard it was for me to learn to shoot until I, you know, figured out what my dominant eye was? And being able to walk to dinner, still carrying that conversation, and smile. That's the difference. You know, in that way, we did accomplish something. In that way, it was very much worth the humiliation, the fear, and the sheer mountain of knowledge that I consumed to try to understand this man. And I think there's some good that came from it.
So as you've alluded to earlier in our conversation, that marriage did not last. And you write about a very painful moment when Donald Trump, I guess right around the time he had been elected, just before, just after, when you and your wife were having a conversation, you sort of blurted out in this moment of deep anger, I hate white people. And she looked at you and said, but I'm white. And you talk about how that was sort of a moment when something you knew intellectually became something that you sort of felt for the first time. And I wonder if, having been through that and having dealt with all these things with guns and race and all the things that you've sort of put into your head and into your heart in this book, whether you feel like you've made some emotional connections that you didn't know you had before, or that were just sort of intellectual things that now you really feel.
I think this all happened at a perfect storm of events, is And I don't think that I would have had the will to continue to do this if I didn't come to some conclusions that I needed to, quite honestly, go to therapy to have a conversation about, to dig deeper into myself, figure out where all this is coming from. And also the knowledge that the person you're sitting next to believes something differently that cannot be sewn up in a manner that it would need to remain married. And in that moment, it just felt like the world was binary. And that's a scary feeling. It's utterly terrifying. And some things came apart too, you know, like so I really am depressed. You know, I had resisted that for years. This YouTube channel, this OU football fandom and all that that's come out of it is a product of this book. I needed to do something that was fun and something that was politically free, something where I could just argue with people on the merits of football as opposed to red versus blue. And believe me, I'm a blue person in a red state. And yet, football was a place for me to continue to grow after this book was finished and to work through some of the lessons that I've learned.
I'm sorry to pick at the scab one more time, but I did find myself wondering at the end of the book, and in these weeks since it's been out, have you talked to your ex or her family or anybody that, do you have any idea how they feel about this?
No, I don't even know if they've read the book. I haven't spoken to anybody in the family in 2 years since my divorce.
I guess to kind of wrap things up a little bit, and you've maybe answered this question in other ways already. In the end, through all this, what do you feel like you learned about yourself?
I was carrying quite a bit of pain, and I'm still carrying that pain, but I am better at processing it. I'm better at understanding that I'm not the only person who's in pain, and I'm not the only person who is afraid. You know, and I think that's valuable. I think being able to walk into a room and know exactly when you should take offense and know when someone else's fears are just kind of on their sleeves and being able to artfully, gracefully, just kind of knock those fears off their shoulders. Well, an example that doesn't necessarily use race is I have been through the education, like I hope most men have, of what Me Too means and what my role in it as a man is. So when I walk into a room, like I taught writing workshop this morning, that's full of girls, my posture matters, right? My fist being open versus closed matters. How I present myself, what verbs I use, what pronouns I use, all this stuff matters. And in some ways, I kind of have learned how to kick people in the shins racially when I'm like, maybe colored's not the word you were going for there. You know, those sorts of instances, the little, what we call microaggressions to be academic about it, but those things matter. And being able not necessarily to take offense, but just see that people are fumbling. And my role of late has been the person for folks to fumble in front of and say, okay, this is why this is faux pas, as opposed to me getting very upset and very mad and either leaving or just seething. And I also think that that's valuable.
Did you keep your guns?
I do. I have both, my Glock 17 and Glock 26.
Do you ever go shoot?
I do not. I don't have any ammo. They stay locked open with slide locks through them. They are paperweights.
And is there a reason for that that you feel like, I know it's, you know, somebody who's dealt with, like, I don't know, I've obviously have some issues with food that if, you know, if I have cookies in the house, I'm going to eat the cookies. Do you feel like if you have bullets in the house, at some point you're going to go down the range and shoot those bullets?
I think that that has to be acknowledged, but it is not at the forefront of my mind. What's at the forefront of my mind is that whether I like it or not, guns were taken away from folks who look like me simply because they look like me, because other folks were afraid of them. And I don't get to pretend that that didn't happen. I have to respect that history, right? It's what I'm getting at with the Bill of Rights, because there was a time when black folks had just got done fighting a war, civil war, and the Union couldn't pay them. And they said, take your guns because we don't have any money. And bandits in white sheets with the eyes cut out and pillowcase went into their houses and stole them because, well, we're afraid you might use those on us because you might feel some kind of way about slavery. And I have to respect that. I don't get to, it's like voting, right? I don't vote necessarily because I feel like I have to be an upstanding citizen. I vote because my grandmother sacrificed everything she had, you know, and I feel the weight of that history all the time. So I will continue to keep my guns and I will continue to keep them as paperweights because that's a symbol in my house and one that I have to respect.
RJ Young, thank you so much for talking to me, man.
Thank you, Tommy. I appreciate you.
Good luck to the Sooners.
Thank you, sir.
You could probably hear the conflict in RJ Young's voice as he talked about his experiences with guns. He knows the damage they do. He thinks way too many of them are in the hands of people who don't know how to use them. But he understands why people feel as though they need them. He's trying to stake out a piece of the middle ground. That's hard to do in our politics these days, especially in the politics of guns. The NRA might be the most effective lobbying group ever created. They've managed to paint anyone who supports even moderate restrictions on guns as un-American. They made any reasonable attempt at gun control pretty much impossible. If you believe in cosmic payback, they got a lot of debts coming due. In the meantime, as RJ said, the rest of us would benefit from getting to know one another better, so we're not so quick to label a stranger as a threat. If we weren't so scared of people who are different from us, we might not be so determined to walk around in this world half-cocked. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our producer is Nick Delacanal. Our web managers are Jessa O'Connor and Zuri Berry. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. And our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and every episode of Southbound on the NPR One app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.
Support for Southbound comes from WFAE members and Southeast Radiation Oncology Group, offering non-invasive alternatives to surgery and treatments in radiation oncology. Details at treatcancer.com. Additional support is provided by the Knight Foundation.